Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you all to our special event this evening entitled Secrecy, Freedom, and Empire, Lessons for Today from Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. Our program features the former Pentagon official and renowned whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and is co-sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Richard and Rhoda Goldman School of Public Policy here at the University of California. For those of you who have not seen his new book, Daniel Ellsberg is the author of Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, which is receiving rave reviews around the country. The Independent Institute regularly sponsors the Independent Policy Forum, a series of lectures, seminars, and debates held here in the San Francisco Bay Area. After 9/11, for example, we began a program to examine the key issues involved, and our event this evening continues that dialogue. In all of our programs, we seek to get beyond left and right and feature speakers who present their own views so that we all have the better opportunity to sift through and make up our own minds. For those of you who are new to our program, the Independent Institute is a nonprofit public policy research organization that sponsors and publishes studies of major issues and conducts many conference and media programs. We invite you to visit our website, which is at independent.org. You'll find further information on our many programs, our books, our journal, which is called The Independent Review. This is the current issue, for those of you who have not seen it. In addition, we invite you to receive a free subscription to our weekly email newsletter called The Lighthouse. I'd like to share with you four quick quotes. Thomas Jefferson once declared that peace and freedom with all mankind is our wisest policy, and I wish we may be permitted to pursue it, unquote. Alexander Solzhenitsyn has stated that, quote, violence does not and cannot exist by itself. It is invariably intertwined with the lie, unquote. To Thomas Paine, quote, it is the duty of the patriot to protect his country from its government, unquote. And last, Henry David Thoreau wrote, quote, there are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root, unquote. I believe that each of these quotes speaks to the remarkable story and courage of our speaker this evening. With the war on terrorism, we face unprecedented new government powers at home and the prospects abroad of a highly dangerous preemptive war as part of a new U.S. policy of global interventionism. Will such actions produce a safer, freer, and more peaceful world? If not, what are the real lessons we should be learning from the past? A couple of quick program matters before we begin. After the discussion, we will have questions from the audience. On the card in the printed program that you hopefully all received, there is a blank that you can jot down any questions you might have, and there'll be ushers roaming the aisles during the program to pick them up. After the question period, we will adjourn, and Dr. Ellsberg will be available to autograph his book in the outer lobby on the mezzanine level. We're particularly pleased to have the Goldman School as a co-sponsor of tonight's program. At this point, I'm delighted to introduce Professor David Kirp, who is here to represent the Goldman School. Professor Kirp received his LLB from Harvard Law School. He's the author of 14 books at last count. And among his many activities is a member of the board of directors of the ACLU of Northern California. David?
I On behalf of the Golden School, it's a pleasure to welcome you and to introduce Daniel Ellsberg. Three decades ago, Daniel Ellsberg's decision to make public 7,000 pages on the history of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam, 1945 to 1968, those classified documents that became known as the Pentagon Papers, influenced the course of the war. Now, even as secrets, his account of that era has been published, we seem poised on the brink of another and at least equally problematic war. It seems to me fitting in two respects for the Goldman School to be a part of this event and a sponsor of this event. For one thing, the school is committed to the kind of rigorous analysis of central policy issues. That rigor has really been the hallmark of Dan Ellsberg's work. If there's a motto, it comes from the title of a book by the founding dean, Speaking Truth to Power. As well, we pay attention to the ethics, not just the analytics of policymaking. I teach an ethics and public policy course. It includes a unit on whistleblowing. You might imagine who one of the star figures is of that material. As well, there's a shared recognition at the school that analysis by itself is not enough, that unless the legitimate concerns of those affected by policy are taken into account, government action will be ineffectual at best and even wrong-headed. And that recognition, too, is consistent with the spirit of Daniel Ellsberg's life work. Now, there's another reason why it's appropriate for me to be here, and that is, had life events unfolded differently, Daniel Ellsberg might not be the author of this book and a figure known to the world, but one of the founding faculty members of the Goldman Policy School. Certainly his own intellectual background is the stuff of public policy. Did a dissertation on decision analysis. He worked with Thomas Schelling, who's one of the founding figures in the public policy field after having worked on military strategy. He had a career that took him to the RAND Corporation, one of the places in which the field of policy analysis has its origins, and then to the government, and careers back and forth from government to public policy are familiar stuff in the policy field. He was one of Robert McNamara's bright young men, and a group who really launched in the aftermath of the disappointment over the failures, perceived failures of the Great Society, launched this field called policy analysis. And one of his bosses at RAND, a fellow named Charlie Wolfe, described in the book as a hawk on Vietnam, became, just a few years later, one of the first directors of RAND's graduate program, which is the counterpart to the Goldman School. Now, I wrote all that before discovering that this bit of counter history turns out to be true, and that on November 14th, 1969, Aaron Woldofsky had Daniel Ellsberg up to interview for a position at the then about to be created Goldman's, well, then Graduate School of Public Policy. He came, but knew he couldn't accept the position because, as he says, by then I was busily copying the Pentagon Papers. As he describes in his book, coming across the Vietnam files was like opening the door of Alibaba's treasure. He'd thought of Vietnam as a worthy effort gone wrong or a case of failed good intentions, and came only gradually to the conviction that American involvement had no legitimacy from the beginning. And then he acted on that conviction. The rest, as they say, is history. One of my colleagues worked at the RAND Corporation in the 1980s. He tells me the story that if you go up to the guards desk and look kind of behind the guards desk at RAND, there's a photo of Dan Ellsberg which says, "Never let this man enter this building." That is surely RAND's loss, if the gain for the rest of us. Today in the Pentagon and the State Department and the CIA, there are files and files and files, cabinets filled with classified documents on the history of American decision-making in Iraq, 1945 to the present. And perhaps there's a Daniel Ellsberg prepared for reasons of principle to take the great personal risk of making those papers available at a New York Times that is willing and prepared to publish them. If so, that would have an enormous impact on our times, even as Dan Ellsberg's decision to make the Pentagon Papers public probably shortened the war in Vietnam. In the meantime, we have the pleasure to hear from Dan Ellsberg himself, a voice whose actions in the past, whose entire life vocation, have enormous continuing relevance today. Dan?
I need some water there. Okay. Watch me spill this in the course of the evening. Okay. I started this book tour about 10 days ago with laryngitis at the beginning of it. And actually, it just went away about a day ago to some extent. But I'm going to speak pretty softly. So can you hear me in the back? Wave your hands if you can. Okay? Very good. If at any point I wander from this mic, or if you can't hear me, please let me know rather than tell me afterwards, what I did hear was so interesting, I wish I'd heard more of it, you know, could have heard you. How many people here saw the little interview that was published by me in the Chronicle this morning? Can I see? Okay, very good. So, you know what I think about Iraq, the war, I don't have to go into that, right? It's what you think, probably, pretty much. And I'll try to talk this evening about history, but actually, I'm not on this tour in this month, which was set up a while ago, obviously, months ago, with no thought that there would be such uncanny timeliness, unhappily, of the history I was speaking here. So I'm very happy, even when I had no voice, to have the opportunity in the last 10 days, not to talk about history, but to do my best to avert that history being repeated, as is in the process of happening right now. And that's what I'm going to appeal to you actually to join in this audience, because I suspect that here in my hometown of Berkeley, I can count on not having to argue with people why this war must not happen and why it's wrong. Anybody out here have this book already? All right. Okay. Class, will you turn to page 7? No, actually, you don't have to turn to it. The people who don't have it yet or don't even buy it tonight can find the chapter I'm about to quote from, chapter 1, on the web, where I put it, thanks to my 24-year-old son, Michael, 3 days ago. Ellsberg.net. ELLSBERG.net, www. Because I told my editors about 3 days ago, as I was reading the daily papers, I want to put this whole book on the net right now. I can't wait for people to buy it. Well, that you can imagine the reaction I got from my editor on the week this went on sale. But I said, okay, just parts of it, chapters 1, 3, and 4. 2 is background. The part that has to do in 1964 with the approach to war before the bombs started falling. And that's the part that needs reading right now. As a matter of fact, I had been sending this with that recommendation to people in Congress before the vote. And now after the vote on the authorization, there's still, the bombs aren't yet falling. So this is the part that people have to read, I think, very quickly. Well, 1, 3, and 4, my editor went up to the upper bigwigs and Vikings and said, chapter 1, can't do 3 and 4. I said, it's only 10% of the book. And said, no, chapter 1. But I negotiated a few pages, which I may get to, on chapter 4, and you'll see why. Because the book begins with my first day as a full-time employee in the Pentagon, having been for some 5 or 6 years about 6 years, a consultant in the Pentagon, occasionally in the White House or the State Department, from the RAND Corporation, with high clearance, higher than top secret, working mainly on nuclear weapons plans, nuclear war plans, an almost year-long study of nuclear crises in 64, which led me to be hired by John McNaughton, who I talked to in the course of that study, former general counsel of the State Department, former Harvard law professor on evidence, now Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, and he asked me to be his special assistant. And I wasn't really interested in being a bureaucrat. I was interested in improving the process, in studying it, in talking really about things that I knew something about. Vietnam was not something I knew about, although I had been there long enough in 1961, several years earlier, to know that there was very little prospect of any kind of success in Vietnam. I'd been there long enough, it took about a week. And that's all it did take, actually. But he said, look, you're interested in crises. Vietnam is one long crisis. This was in July of 64. And he said, you'll study it from the inside. You'll learn things you have not learned as a consultant about how the government really works. And that was true. So on my first day, starting in the book, chapter 1, page 7, I didn't even have an office yet. I was assigned a desk next to the secretary's because my predecessor as special assistant hadn't yet moved out of the little cubbyhole, the office next to the assistant secretary. So I was just sitting at a desk there waiting to read cables and to learn about this new job when a courier from the message center came running into the office. Asked for the assistant secretary, who wasn't there at the time. He directed to me, the special assistant, and he handed me a cable, which was very dramatic, from a Captain Herrick, who was the commodore of a two-destroyer flotilla in the South China Sea in the Tonkin Gulf just off the coast of North Vietnam. It was a flash cable, and the reason he was running said, "I'm under continuous torpedo attack." Now, this was at 10:30, I have it here, I had to look this up, of course, on the time. I remember the occasion, and I checked in various textbooks now on the when that time was. The first cable was 10:42 a.m. Washington time, 9:42 a.m. in the Tonkin Gulf, p.m. So it was the time zones changed in the middle of the Tonkin Gulf, so there's a lot of confusion, actually, as to which time zone a particular ship was in, but it was essentially 12 or 13 time zones away. So morning in Washington was night in the Tonkin Gulf, and it happened to be a moonless night, very choppy, clouded over, no light at all, no stars, no nothing. All that could be seen was on radar scopes or listened to on sonar, and that was the basis for the reporting that was coming in. The reporting was very dramatic because one cable after another kept getting run into me. I never had an experience after this again, and I don't know how many there have been really since then. This was not an ordinary event. This was the second time that a U.S. naval ship had been attacked by anyone since the Second World War. The first time had been, this was August 4th, had been 2 days earlier. In daylight in the Tonkin Gulf on a Sunday afternoon, nighttime in Washington, Saturday night in Washington, so not too many people were in the office. The president wasn't in. But the president then on Sunday morning got the word that there had been this attack. It lasted about 20 minutes. Torpedoes had been fired. They all missed. Machine guns had been fired from the patrol boats of the North Vietnamese. Indeed, when we were looking for evidence that there had been a second attack on August 4th, my predecessor, Alvin Friedman, who is now was sworn in as a deputy assistant secretary to give him a little more authority when he went to the Tonkin Gulf to find out what had happened. And he came back with a 50 caliber bullet that had lodged in the superstructure of Herrick's ship. And I've held that bullet in my hand. It came back and got quite a historic artifact. The bullet that started the U.S. escalation in Vietnam. that lasted quite a long time. But 2 days then after that actual attack, which occurred, were these reports now of a second attack in the face of the president's warning that any other repetition of that, and we hadn't reacted to the first one, any repetition would have the gravest consequences. And in the face of that warning, here again they were doing it. So the other dramatic thing about this was that as flash cables, they were coming in as they were received in the Pentagon. I looked at the clock, I looked at the date time group on the cable and could see that it had been sent about half an hour before. Now, a flash cable was supposed to arrive at its destination in 10 minutes. That was the definition of flash, but very hard to achieve that. And actually, I wasn't the first person seeing these, of course. It was going to the president, it was going to the Secretary of Defense. So what I was seeing was something, reports of something that was actually happening about half an hour earlier. But since they were coming to me minute after minute, it was like real time. And there was no CNN then, where you could watch events live halfway across the world. As a matter of fact, there was no radio contact directly with those ships from Washington. So this was as close to a kind of CNN version, a real-time version, as you could get. And apparently, Herrick was dictating cables one after another from the bridge of the destroyer while he was taking evasive action in the dark there to avoid these torpedoes. And here's what I was reading, and this is verbatim. Torpedo missed. Another fired at us. Four torpedoes in water. Five torpedoes in water. Have successfully avoided at least six torpedoes. Nine torpedoes had been fired at a ship, 14, 26 in all at the two ships. More attacking boats had been sunk, hit, at least one sunk. This went on for over an hour, not just 20 minutes for extraordinary thing, as I was watching these. The reason I was getting these cables was that my boss was down the hall with Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, planning, picking the targets to be hit in response, because the president, on even before the torpedoes were fired, on the basis of intelligence reports from Herrick that he believed that he was being shadowed by torpedo boats, there was an ambush, he believed he was going to be attacked, the president had already decided on August 4th, the morning of it, that we would retaliate this time. And McNaughton, my boss, was picking the targets with Joint Chiefs representatives. So I was getting all these cables together to show him when he got back in order. Kept coming in. 26 was a surprising number, though to experts more surprising than to me. This was my first day on the job. They knew, which I didn't know, that 26 torpedoes was more than we had estimated was in the entire inventory of the North Vietnamese Navy. And there were other odd things about this to intelligence experts, such as no radio signals, no radar signals from the boats. How had they found these destroyers on a moonless night without radar in the middle of the South China Sea at that point? But anyway, the cables were coming fast, more torpedoes, and then a cable that for many years I could remember verbatim, but now I have to look it up. I was having a discussion with my great friend and great historian, Bart Bernstein, who was expressing skepticism very very properly about my memory of the conversations that I gave so long ago. And I said, you're absolutely right to raise these questions. I'll just tell you, he thought I should have put this in the book. My memory for discussions and cables and things that I wrote, that I read 35 years ago was, and even is, extraordinary. Last week, no, anymore. Ask me tomorrow what questions people ask me tonight, and I will have some problem with it. But where I could in this book, of course, I'm using the actual cables. And this new cable or memos that I wrote at the time, which can also be found, a lot of them on the web. This book isn't just this book. It's also the outtake section of www.ellsberg.net. I put all the memos on that and a lot of other stuff. The book would have been three times as long if my two sons, especially my young son, Michael, who called himself in the editing process Jack the Ripper, had not slashed at this book. So a cable comes in that suddenly says, in effect, full stop. Quote, review of action makes many reported contacts and torpedoes fired appear doubtful. Freak weather effects on radar and overeager sonar man may have accounted for many reports. No actual sightings visually by Maddox, his ship. Suggest complete, another peculiarity that turned up very quickly within an hour was all the sonar, these two ships were very close together in the water. Only the Maddox heard sonar reports. The other ship didn't hear any. And only the other ship had radar contacts. The Maddox couldn't see any. There's peculiar things about it right from the beginning. But this message at 2 o'clock from the commander of the ships, you know, was quite a cold bath to me reading this stuff. And a few minutes later, this was a little after 2 p.m. in the afternoon Washington time, Herrick sent another cable. Entire action leaves many doubts except for apparent attempted ambush at beginning. Suggest thorough reconnaissance in daylight by aircraft. Now this was, had been sent 1:27 Washington time. So it's, you know, the middle of the night there. So daylight was a few hours away. The point of reconnaissance was to look for wreckage or oil slicks or even bodies in the water because they believed they'd hit 2 to 4 boats and destroyed them. See if there's any evidence they had actually been under attack, which, to leap ahead here, they had not been. There was no second attack. But certainly earlier in the day, we had all assumed there was an attack. And there was some other evidence which was misleading and misinterpreted at the highest levels by McNamara and Johnson, which I'm almost sure did lead them to believe that despite Herrick's doubts, there probably had been an attack, or even certainly had been an attack. That was a mistaken interpretation, not shared by intelligence analysts at the time. And the head of intelligence, Ray Klein, in the CIA, had informed the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board 2 days later that the evidence they were relying on, which was communications intercepts, had been misinterpreted. Almost certainly there had been no attack. But that was a day before Congress voted on the first Tonkin Gulf resolution, which was based on the president's, on Secretary of Defense and Secretary Rusk's top secret testimony in hearings, rather brief hearings, to the Congress on the 5th and 6th of August. And the statements by McNamara that night, August 4th, a night I spent entirely all night in the Pentagon watching the progress of these raids, the first raids against North Vietnam. I was to spend other nights all night, but my first day in the Pentagon as a full-time employee was 24 hours long. And about 11 o'clock at night, the president informed the public, and Secretary of Defense then briefed them at length, reported, we are retaliating to an attack, an unprovoked attack, and in McNamara's words, unequivocal evidence of an unprovoked attack on our destroyers on routine patrol in international waters. We seek no wider war. By that night, and certainly within a couple of days, I knew each one of those statements was false. And I knew it not just orally, I had documentary evidence of that from the cables. I won't go through it, it's in the book. But unequivocal, it could not have been more equivocal. And in fact hadn't taken place, but they did believe it, but it was extremely equivocal to say that it was what Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld would say, bulletproof evidence, was a lie, was a lie. And it would appear, by the way, that the CIA has been saying to Congress right now that that is a false statement. They have no evidence of links from Iraq to Al-Qaeda. I'm going to try tonight not to start with these connections and just go on the history here for a minute. And I won't go through why it was all a lie. I'm just saying unprovoked, no, it had been provoked deliberately, or at least by very provocative actions. And indeed, when we found that we could get the North Vietnamese on Sunday, on August 2nd, actually to attack a ship. A flurry of excitement went through the Pentagon of all new ways to get more reactions out of them to which we could respond. And unequivocal, no. International waters, well, yes, at the time of attack, because that's why they were fleeing into international waters, having been very provocatively sailing right very as close as they could get, and within what we knew the North Vietnamese regarded as their territorial waters before the alleged attack. No wider war,